All right. Last time we looked at chapter 1, and one of the things that I wanted to kind of emphasize last time was the fact that as you start out, the vanity of life is introduced. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity and vexation of spirit, or striving after wind, and other translations that will sometimes have that. The point of all of that is to look at life by itself. Life just under the sun, just look at it in a physical sense, does not make sense. It doesn't give a kind of a sense of purpose. It doesn't give a sense of fairness. It doesn't give any direction that's there, just as you look at it in this life. But what it does is it suggests there is something there. You look at the things that are around, and there's enough order, there's enough things that are cyclical, that it has some design. But it's not something that we can figure out the purpose of, how it goes about. The function of it many times escapes us as well. And so while it points at God, which is the point of Romans chapter 1 beginning out, that God is seen, His everlasting power and divinity are seen through the things that are made. That's true. But the idea of what His plan is not seen. So I want to begin to notice, we wanted to start out last time with just that point, just by itself you do not understand the nature of life by life under the sun. You don't see how that purpose exists. You don't see a direction, a design, an ethic that is pointed out. None of that is there. But there's enough suggested about God's presence, His being, that you start to look for it. And you find out that it's not found in the world, in nature. You have to look to God's order as it's revealed to find out His will and ethic. And that point is going to be something that we're going to make in an advancing way as we go through there. The first part of it is going to be heavy on this part of the vanity of things, the vanity of all of these as we go through. The last part, we're going to have words of wisdom where it's heavy on the other side of that. That we know this is right because of who God is and what we see about the nature of good and evil and the fact of what we just see as a sense of right and wrong. That there is that that is recognized. And that has to point us to God. And that's going to be the kind of a progress as you go through this. You look at this world, a lot of things are just baffling as to why they happen the way that they do. But that suggests to us that this earth by itself, this world by itself, does not make up the full of our experience. We're intended to look outside of it for that. Now, what we're going to do this evening is look at these next two points, the vanity of pleasure and the vanity of earthly wisdom and folly. In other words, recognizing the things that are under the sun, seen as that which is of pleasure. Is there a purpose that it serves or not? If there is, what is it? And what's the limitation of that? Is there a wisdom that's in this world? Is it good for anything? Or we just say, well, folly's just as good as wisdom entirely? Well, we're going to look at those things as we go through tonight, and we're just going to kind of scratch the surface of some of it, if you will, as we're going into this. Let's start looking here at chapter 2. When you look at the things that are pointed out, that's chapter 3. Are you sure that's the one I sent you? I want chapter 2. I know it does, but that's not chapter 2. Everything there is a season is chapter 3, even though I've got it up there. Oh boy, we did one of these things. All right, everybody open your Bible. We'll go the old-fashioned way, okay? Somebody want to volunteer to read for me verses 1 through 8? Okay, Kurt, go ahead.
Chapter 3, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, It is mad. It is pleasure. What use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men.
All right. You might notice there in the latter part of verse 8, what are you using? What version?
That's ESV.
Okay. ESV, if you'll notice, it puts in concubines. There is an alternate reading that's there. And most cases, and I think what should be there in the text, is the word musical instruments, the delights of the sons of men and musical instruments. That seems to me to be the case for the stronger evidence of the text. There in your question 1 of chapter 2, the different pursuits of pleasure. Name some of them that he just went through. What? Do what? Pleasure, okay. In what sense? What specifics does he give?
Wine.
All right, wine?
Laughter.
Possessions that are there, in what sense? What all possessions did he have? Build houses, do what? Vineyards, gardens, had the stuff to water it as well. That was an arid land, you remember, so irrigation of that would have been necessary. What else? Do what? Okay, servants, male and female. Those bought, and what else? Those who are born in the house. That's somebody that's a measure of great wealth. To acquire servants, buying them, is not as much as having some that are born within the house. That shows a background of some manner of wealth in which there have been slaves. What else?
Silver and gold.
Okay. You've got all this. Now, how much money did he to have all of that? That's my question. More than I got, right? More than you've got. It's an intense degree of wealth. Did he find his reason for life in all of that? Okay. Did he find some joy out of it? Sure. How did he find joy out of that? Do what? Okay. Is life of a poor man or a rich man easier in day-to-day existence? All right. Easier for the rich if you're going to talk about existence. Now, in the sense of the cares that one has, what one has to do to keep up all of those pursuits, to keep them going, to keep all of those people functioning and provided for and all of that. Now, in those cares, which has the easier way of life? All right. Poor man does. Solomon's going to talk about in the book of Proverbs that a poor man can sleep with a kind of a sense of ease from the care, but not a rich man. He's going to have to be involved in those things. They're going to be called to his mind all the time. When you look at this point that's there that I had, I want to point your attention specifically to verse 3. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. That tells me a little bit about the kind of wisdom that he talks about. When you look over in the book of Proverbs, the wisdom that Solomon and various of the wise men, the king and so forth, that are talked about. What do you know about wine that it says there in a way of wisdom as God inspired it in a moral sense? What did he say to do with the wine? Don't even look at it when it's red in the cup. Why? All right. The last, it goes down like a serpent, stings like an adder. In other words, it bites like a snake. He goes on to talk about from that that what you do is you wake up with wounds that you don't know why you've got. You're there at the without being on a ship, and yet you're swaying all of the time. The drunkenness that's there. You're in brawls. You're in all of these things that have to do with a constant sense of confrontation and conflict with people. Is that pretty much the way people who are into wine live? Sure. You look at it, and that's the idea that's there. They get into troubles that are a result of that. So the wisdom end of that would tell me to stay away from it entirely. From that point of view, the kind of wisdom we're talking about in Proverbs. Now, why does he say that I find mirth with wine, and yet I had wisdom? When you're looking at that wine, does that always mean an intoxicant? No. Not in either the Old Testament or New Testament. The word used here is the word yayin, or yanin, sometimes they'll call it. But yayin is probably the correct pronunciation. Yayin is the word that is used most often. It's what's used as a sacrifice in many cases, an offering out. But that sacrifice is always poured out when it's seen as approved. There are also times when it's very clear that yayin at times has something that is of some alcoholic content anyway, that it's somewhat fermented, that it's not new. At times you have it distinguished from what came fresh from the grape, which is always called tirash in the Hebrew language. And so most of the time, I would say, you have this word yayin. It has some level of fermentation, some level of alcoholic content, but it's not the one that's normally used to get drunk. That's the word shekar. Shekar is what's oftentimes translated strong drink. That's what somebody uses, especially if it's something that's without any kind of a cutting or without any kind of a sense of being deluded that it would cause someone to go into drunkenness. That word is almost always shekar. Now, here's my point. I don't know which one is true here, but it's one of two ways in the book of Ecclesiastes. If he's talking about using that wine but with wisdom, that may mean the sense of that you would use it when there was that which would cause illness within the stomach. Water was many times that which could not be trusted in ancient times. Well-known practice going back really to about 3,500 B.C. that they would mix some of that with the water in order to purify. That could be what's talked about here, the kind of yayin that would be of a diluted portion that wouldn't make one drunk. That takes place in the New Testament when the standard was at least 4 to 6 parts water to 1 part wine. That was enough to destroy the bacteria, but it was not enough to cause one to drink unless you drank at the place of about 2 gallons per hour. You're going to have problems with something else before you have it with your mind there. But those kind of things that take place, it could be that. However, it may be that he's talking about yayin, which was an uncut thing, which was not a matter of what ought to be drunk. That word is used in the Proverbs when he talks about the sense of don't look at it when it's red in the cup. Now, in what sense would he maintain his wisdom there? Doing what's wrong, but yet knowing what was right. Does knowing what's right cause you to do what's right always? No. I have to know what's right before I do what's right. But knowing what's right doesn't always cause me to do what's right. I can understand the lack of wisdom in doing what I've done. And it may be that he's talking about that. And which one is here, I'm not sure of. Anybody want to make a comment or have a kind of a studied kind of a comment that you'd like to add in there? I'm just not sure on that point. I've never been able to get my mind settled on one or the other, but one of those has to be the ideal, one or the other. All right, now, when you look at the rest of this, about all of these gardens, vineyards, servants, everything else that was there that he acquired, what was the problem with it? I mean, when he got through with it, what does he see? Do what? Why? That's right, vanity. Why? When you've done that, what have you got? All right. You've got all the pleasure that's coming right then. It's absolutely exhausted at that point. In a different, entirely different way, but I want you to think about it in the book of Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus talks in chapter 6, beginning about how the one that prays to be seen of men has received their reward already. But the one who goes and does that in private, not to be seen of men, so that he might be complimented and honored by men, but so that that's with God, what about him? His reward remains. His reward's in heaven. In a different sense, I recognize, but that's the idea that's here. The person who lives with the kind of a wisdom that would be, is there any joy in this? Is there any good that comes? Yeah, there's some good. But the good is what you got at the moment. It's not something that provides for the future. For instance, if you had a crop that you were tending and cared for 1 year, and then you let it totally go the next year, what happened? All right, you got weeds. You got very little fruit, if any, that comes up from that, depending on what happens. And it'll be less and less as time goes by. In other words, you got the use of what you did when you did it. At the harvest, you got it. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to get that same harvest over and over and over every year. Saying what? These various things that we have in life, do they produce some good? Yes. But not a lasting good. And what does man recognize? As we live in this life, what do we all have? Is this all there is? There's got to be something else. Solomon's also going to talk about God has put eternity in the hearts of men. You don't find any animal thinking about eternity. That's something that's there of man because of the capacity of reason and the sense of moral awe that God gives with man. All right, anything else there? Go ahead.
It just reminds me, you know, our lives are, if you live them like it's an asset, you know, if you live this type of lifestyle, it's a depreciable asset, and eventually it gets old and boring, and you want to seek after something else that's vanity also. Yet our lives as Christians ought to be the opposite. It appreciates, and it only gets better until we get to our full reward.
Exactly. All right. The statement comes down in verse 9 then. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And now he says this. This is where we wanted to get to in verses 10 and 11 with regard to the so what of this particular point. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labors in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. That sense of any lasting good is the sense of the word prophets there. That is the idea that he's making. All of this had its reward at that particular time. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure. Well, he could certainly have anything that money would buy. And a lot of friends come with money, at least as long as you got the money. When you lose the money, there go the friends, just like with the product. But you have that kind of a sense, I had all of this pleasure. And when I got down to it and looked at it, what I see? Vanity. It's all emptiness. Why? Because when you had the pleasure, you had it. It's gone. There's nothing left from that. There's no profit, and certainly there is no purpose. He doesn't see a purpose for his existence. Nothing that separates him from others. Nothing that gives a lasting sense of a good that is to be done. Anybody else got anything there?
I would just say, that the whole idea here about this, we just see total self-centeredness. We totally see day-to-day worldly things in this example. I mean, we see people like this. And it says, I, 10 times in, I think, 5 verses. I. And so the self-centeredness. And so we learn real quickly, where does self-centeredness get you as we look in these verses? Nowhere.
Yeah. There's nothing that's going to be accomplished from this for any lasting good. All right. You depressed yet? Okay. Well, all of this has a purpose. There's two sides of this that you want to avoid. The one is just be a hermit, and we ought to beat ourselves and deny ourselves any kind of joy whatsoever in this earthly life. That's the idea that's there of a lot of those that went into monks. The sense is, if I have a lot of suffering and no pleasure, then I'm made holier by that. No, I'm not. Colossians 2 covers that pretty clearly in showing that that's not the point. The other side of it is, well, if there's some pleasure that comes out of all these things, then I just need to go whole hog into it and do that all the way. That's not right either. Where do you find the wisdom? The true sense of understanding the place for pleasure. You look at, there's something that's pointed out in the middle of that. And is that just saying, well, there's this one and this one. I'm going to look halfway in between and that's the place. No. You're looking for God's wisdom in it. God will point out the wisdom of what place it does have, what good is there, and what isn't the good that comes from it. Go ahead, Jason.
Jumping ahead of you or anything to look at Philippians 4:12, where Paul said, I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have excess. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed, hungry, or whether living in plenty or want.
And we're going to look at that a little bit later briefly in Ecclesiastes, but the book that covers that more than any is Job. Is there a good in suffering? This talks about our purpose, but we also have a common existence that has suffering as part of this life under the sun. That's what Job talks about especially in notes. You have to have it. It does you good in the end analysis. All right. Now, let's go to verse 12. Let me look and see. Verse 12 through 17. Will somebody read that, please? Go ahead, Scott.
I'm not reading after Kurt. Did you hear his voice?
Hey. He's got a better voice than mine, so what? Get on. Thankful God gave it to him.
Then I turn myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it this also is vanity, for there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die as the fool? Therefore I hated life because of the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind.
Okay. Let me ask you this. From overall, these verses, what's the main point? Can you give it to me in one sentence? Okay. That's one phrase. But I mean, what's the point? I know it's headed at life under the sun, but what does he see? Give me a synopsis of this. Go ahead.
The final analysis from a human standpoint, his wisdom really did him no good. He was going to die.
Okay.
Just like a fool.
Okay. You look at a fool, you look at a wise man. Can you tell the difference between them by their death? Sometimes, maybe, you see somebody that's a fool, he takes out and tries to jump the Grand Canyon in a motorcycle that hadn't been souped up. Yeah, I can pretty well pick out the fool. There's here's your sign kind of thing. But the point that's here is, you look at both of them, they die a lot. In other words, natural deaths happen all the time. They happen to all kinds of different people. He's going to talk about the same thing later on with regard to animals and bring that especially up in the next chapter. But look at verse 12, because this hits to the point. Who was Solomon's father? David. Verse 12. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. All of us, especially I think men, have that sense of an accomplishment that you want to do. You're driven. Now some, I guess, don't. And they're kind of lackadaisical about things, but most men have that drive. I want to do something. The pride of that gets into the idea, I want to do something nobody's done before. I want to be famous. And that's driven in the direction of self. Whether Solomon's got that or not. Let me ask you to think of, you're Solomon, your dad, David, was the king before you. He died. What can you do as a king that David didn't do?
Good question.
He's already come to the point of extending the border to its ultimate point. That's the very sense of the end, when you're looking at 2 Samuel and you're looking at Chronicles. You notice just that point. He had reached that so that there could be his son was a man of peace. The second reason why God told Samuel to tell David that he could not build the temple was why? You're a man of war. Who had told him to go to war? God did. Why? Because the law had pointed out that that was the end. There was to be this warfare until there had been peace brought within the borders that God had given. In the promise to Abraham that was there, there would be peace within those borders. That was accomplished by the end of David's kingship. Now you've got Solomon, and he can build the temple. But was there anything that his dad had to do with that? Yeah, he made the provisions. David had put together all of those provisions to be sure that Solomon could do that. All right. Now, in the sense of the order of worship, who had put the Levites and the priests into a system of order so that there were always those to serve and backups to the ones who were going to serve in case the others could not? David. With regard to those who were singers and getting them to be a part of the worship, could Solomon improve on what his dad David had? Nope. You look at everything that was accomplished with regard to worship, the peace within the kingdom and all. If Solomon was looking at it, he says, if I'm going to be accomplishing something, all I can do, best he could ever hope for, is to do as good as his dad had done. Now he doesn't. He's a fool. And he doesn't act with wisdom in the moral sense. But that was what he saw. Now, how would that tend to make you feel if you're Solomon and you're trying to think about what can I accomplish in my life? In one sense, it'll tell you, you can't cause yourself to be elevated in such a way that you're just a unique king, except for the wisdom that God gave him that was greater. There wasn't any way in which that would be done. But what could he do? Without that kind of pride entering in, what could he recognize? I need to submit myself to my father and do what he did. Recognize the good that was there. That would have required courage. David had the wisdom to know what was right. Solomon had the wisdom to know what was right. Solomon did not have the courage that his father had to do what was right, even when it meant changing, recognizing the need to humble himself and repent before God and before man. That's the problem. And as Solomon is writing this, I want you to think about it from that point of view. That's who it is. Verse 12 sets that up. Okay, what am I going to do in achievement in life? And the sense of it, it's whatever you do, it's not going to outweigh what your father has done. And you look at it. Now if you're a Solomon, you have a son. What's his name? You think Rehoboam just suddenly became a fool at the end of the life of Solomon? You don't do that. He saw that, right? Here's his dad, he died. Here's him, he's going to die. Here's Rehoboam who comes up on after him. He has to have a pretty good idea. Rehoboam's going the wrong direction too, because very clearly he had done that from the time that he was a youth. So what does he see? I think we need to read that, think about that, to really get the full sense of what's being talked about in verses 12 through 17. To notice the idea of, here's a wise man and a fool, they all die. They're going to come to the end of their life. There's not any difference. A wise man doesn't live forever, and a fool doesn't live forever. You have them all ending up, and they seem to die in the same sort of way. All right, anything else there? Okay. Trying to hurry through here. Verse 18 to 23, someone. Go ahead, DJ.
Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. And he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore, I turned my heart and spared of all the labor in which I toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must have his heritage to a man. He must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work wearisome. Even the night his heart takes no rest.
Okay, here you've got a follow-up from the one before. He just goes into a little bit greater depth. What obviously was Solomon searching for at this time? He didn't find it, but what he's searching for is something that he can do, some pursuit, wisdom versus the folly or the things of accomplishment. What can he do that in the end will say, this is my purpose for life? I've made sense of what life is all about by this particular thing that I've done or achievement I've come to in life under the sun. He recognizes nothing like that is there. For one thing, as he points out, here comes along a fool after him. That could take place. And again, I think the point is we have that which is clearly the Holy Spirit inspiring Solomon. This has to be a universal subject. But I also understand we need to look into the background that's here. And surely you have Solomon recognizing those tendencies in his son Rehoboam to be a fool. And have concerns about what's going to happen to the kingdom after he's gone. Here's the one that comes after him, and what happens? It's destroyed. So what has he done? Think about Solomon. Here he is, the end of his life. He looks out at these gardens. He looks out at all of these things that have been built. He looks out at everything that's there. All of that requires a great amount of money. Where does his money come from? Taxation. Where does his taxation come from? The kingdom that he has. What happens if that divides more than in two? And he's left with a minority of that. What happens to all the things that Solomon had built? Can he keep them up? And later on, down the line, you see the things that Solomon had done had gone into decay. And the Scripture tells us about that in a number of cases. I think there's some things here that Solomon recognizes the possibility, if not the probability, of that. Now, he spent all of this time doing that. What does he not spend his time doing? Fearing God and keeping his commandments. That's why when you look at all this, keep that in your mind where we're going. Because when you look at all that, here's everything he has. I think about some of these people who die with all kinds of worldly wealth. And in their dying breaths, I kind of wonder, do they see the vanity of this? Do they recognize that everything that they've spent their life for is probably going to be something that's destroyed or fought over in the courts or whatever else? They've got to have seen that before. They have to be discouraging. The point of it is, if that's where all of our pursuits are, have we spent our life wisely? Have we spent our life in a way that makes a difference or that does something in a continuing way? The answer's no. All right. Anything else there? All right, if somebody will read those last few verses, 24 through 26, please.
There is nothing better than for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner he has given the task of gathering, collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind.
Okay. That statement in verse 25, are you reading ESV?
New American Standard.
Okay. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment? What does that say? Without him, okay. The words more than I and without him are the textual variants there. The words without him are found in the Septuagint version, the Syriac version, and a number of the versions that are, I say, the better ones. The New King James and the King James use the statement more than I. I don't think that's what the original had very clearly. I think the mass evidence is there for that without him. And so you look at that here, for who can eat or who can have enjoyment without him. In other words, all of this was from the hand of God, verse 24. So I couldn't even do this without God to begin with. What does that tell me? He's been a part of that. This is that beginning entrance way. This is what Solomon's going to do. He's going to keep adding in this little point about bringing God into it. This is the first one of those interjections that you have. And so the point is, all of these things of eating and drinking, when you've enjoyed those the way that you should, you had them from God, so you enjoyed them there. That came from God in the first place. So without Him, would you have had it? So what should that do? It should turn us back to God. Have you ever made provisions, but you know the provisions you made were not as good as what you got? How do you explain that? I can't explain it because of what I deserve. Because maybe somebody else made provisions even better than I did, and they didn't get anything. It tells me there's something else besides just my provisions and my work behind it. So I've got to look beyond that. And here you recognize Solomon sees, he knows enough of wisdom to know God is the one that's behind that. And so what I received, but really God was behind it. For, he says, verse 26, God, and I think that's correct, that's an insertion. But if it is correct that phrase at the end of verse 26 says, without Him, speaking of God, then he's correctly pointing out, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. To the sinner, what does he give? Work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. Now, is that an always, this always happens without fail? No, same way as you find in the Proverbs. Proverbs are general rules. They are not absolute measures. That's what they're intended to be. We talk about the general rule is you do these kind of things. Now, God directs things to those who can properly use them. I've seen that so many times in my life, and you have too, that it was directed away, provisions directed away from what might harm one and ultimately brought to do some good that was there because of who would follow after that and what they would do with it. His point then, that he may give to him who is good before God, this also is vanity and grasping for wind. In what sense? If I recognize that God has to be behind this, how's that vanity and grasping after wind? I could be doing everything I can, using all of my power, all of my wisdom, all of my work to get things going in a certain direction, and yet it might not work, and the benefit will go to somebody else. Now, what's one possibility? God may be directing that through His providence. From my point of view, what good has happened from my work? None. And that's the point that he's talking about, from the sense of life under the sun. When that was diverted from the one who did the work, did that help him? No, it didn't help him. But it helped ultimately as God intervened through his providence. We've got to look at that part of it. And that's going to be something, like I say, as a part of this interjection, you're going to see this more and more. This is an interesting book. I don't know how many times I had gone through the book of Ecclesiastes and teaching it in my early time in preaching. And all of a sudden, I started to go back through it again in Alvin, and I looked and I thought, here are all these things that God added into here since I taught it last time. And no, that wasn't the problem. I just didn't see them. And you had all of these interjections, and I missed them. And so I just thought, okay, here's the vanity, and then here's the wisdom later on. What he's doing is talking about the vanity, and he'll put in that little piece. And what it does is it helps us understand bit by bit how much there is of wisdom in this book. in recognizing Solomon did. He spent all this time doing worldly things. And in the end, he wasted it. He should have been spending that time with the things that were not under the sun, those that were beyond the sun. All right. Let's look real quick at a few of the I want that last question. I think that's about all the time we've got. What limitations did he, speaking of Solomon, find in wisdom during his life under the sun? What are the limitations? Okay. Okay. He's going to die. Goes away at that time. What else? Okay. Okay. There are things that are there, but just for that time. Is it always productive? It might be that you do it and it doesn't do any good for you at all. What else?
If it is productive, you're going to have to leave it in the hands of someone else that comes after you.
That's right. You're either going to lose it before or at death, and you're certainly going to lose it at death, and somebody else is going to have that if you still got a hold of it at that point. All right. Well, thanks. We'll leave it there. Who's leading the closing prayer? Okay. Sorry. Thanks. Go ahead and do that, and then we'll be dismissed.